Great. So we are very bottom of the daf, Sadi Chesem Beis. And hopefully today we will turn it daf to Sadi Tesem et al, a major accomplishment in our scope of things. We are up to 5 lines from the bottom of the daf, about 7 or 8 words from the end of the line, Amar Rav Yehuda, Amar Rav. Everybody have it? Amar Rav Yehuda, Amar Rav. Rav Yehuda said the name of Rav. Continuing our very, very extensive discussion of the Mashiach. Aser HaKadosh Baruch Hu laha'amid lahem David Acher. In the future, HaKadosh Baruch Hu will bring to us another David HaMelech. We had one way back in history. And in the future, we will have another. Shenemar, as it says, V'ivdu es Hashem Elokehem es David Malkam, and they will serve Hashem their God in the future, and David their king, Asher Akim Lahem, which I will establish for them. Hakim lo nemar, it didn't say I did establish, Ela Akim, in other words, I will establish. There will come a time in the future when there will be a David who will be king of the Jewish people, and the Jews will serve God under his sovereignty. Well, that sounds like the Navi is prophesying that there will be a future King David who will rule over us as there was a King David and who ruled over us in the past. Now, that can mean a lot of different things. The most simple, plausible reading would be that there will be another king whose name will be David, who will rule over us. Kind of would be the simplest reading, that in the future there will be a king by the name of David, and he will rule over the Jewish people. Maybe, you know, we've been talking about the names of the Mashiach, maybe his name will be David. That would be kind of the simplest reading, but that's not exactly where the Gemara goes. The Gemara continues, Amalei Rav Papa La Abaye. Rav Papa said to Abaye, V'haksiv, it says elsewhere in Yecheskel, V'David Avdi Nasi Lahem Li'olam. David, my king, will be David, my servant, will be a king for them, a leader for them forever. So it's not the case that there will be a future David, a future David HaMelech, but the same David HaMelech will rule long into the future. He will be a ruler forevermore. Now, how would you interpret that pasuk simply? Like, how would you interpret it? What does it mean to say that David will be king forevermore? Does it mean he's going to live forever? David HaMelech didn't live forever. We know that he died. It says so explicitly in the Navi. So what does it mean to say that David will be a Nasi forever, a leader forever? How do you interpret that just simply? What is a simple reading of that pasuk? What do you think? Well, one possible reading, Howard, do you want to suggest something? I think I see your hand up. Mrs. Gesudo, where's Lynn? Oh, you're muted.
Sorry, okay. It's like Paro, you know, when it's a Paro, Melech Chadash, is it something new? I mean, it could be the house of David or, you know, from his descendants.
Right, so one simple reading would be that the Davidic dynasty will last eternally. In other words, there will be descendants of David, whatever the name is, but they will follow through in David's traditions, and in that sense, they will follow through in his Mesorah, in his ideals, in his way of leading, in his Kedusha. And in that sense, David's will reign forever because all of his descendants will be following in the powerful, beautiful footsteps of David HaMelech. So that would be, I think, the simplest reading. But the Gemara reads a different...
Okay. Couldn't you also say that there will be Triyas HaMesim?
Yes, so that's another possibility. Yes, I'm glad you suggested that. That is another possibility. The Devil will be resurrected. The thing is that Tchias HaMesim is usually thought to take place after the arrival of the Mashiach, not simultaneous with or before. And we'll certainly see that in the Gemara upcoming, next off. So, yeah, it's a possibility, but it doesn't work with the chronology that the Gemara adopts for Tchias HaMesim and Mashiach. As we'll see in the Gemara, and next daf indicates that the period, the Messianic era, will be a very temporary one. The Gemara debates how long it will be, but after the end of the Messianic era, there will be Tchias HaMesim. So it would be a possibility, but it doesn't fit with the chronology of the Gemara, at least in the next daf. So the Gemara kind of doesn't take either of these simple readings and, you know, is determined, you might say, to read them midrashically as opposed to simply or literally. And why the Gemara has that predilection is a really good question. But the Gemara here sees a contradiction between these two psukim. One pasuk says that there will be in the future a David who will come and rule over the Jewish people. And the other pasuk says that the old David will eternally rule over the Jewish people. And the Gemara regards that as a contradiction. As I say, not self-evident by any means. This is kind of one of the ways that the Gemara logic doesn't follow the logic that we 21st century Americans do. It's just that it reads it a little bit from a pshat perspective, maybe perversely or differently. And that's not so uncommon. One finds that. The Gemara has these readings of Psukim. Could be that they had this old oral tradition to this kind of reading, which they were heirs to and were articulating. Put in different terms, the Gemara says as follows. We go on Kezar Upalge Kezar. So Abaye answered Rava to reconcile these two conflicting psukim by asserting that there will be a Caesar and a half Caesar. Now, what does a half Caesar mean? Half the size, the Caesar's usually 6 feet, it'll be 3 feet. Like, what does a half Caesar mean? So Rashi and other Mepharshim say that it means a deputy Caesar, Caesar being the Roman Latin word for ruler. So there will be the prime minister, shall we say, let's say, not really prime minister, ministerial government, but king and a deputy king, viceroy. The royal and the viceroy. So one David will be the king, and the second David will be the viceroy. I ask you the following question, which is which? Will the old David be miraculously either revived through Tchias HaMesim, or will the old David's model be the king and the new David will be the deputy or the viceroy? Second line. Viceroy means second, vice, you know, second assistant king. Roy is the Latin word for king. As Louis XIV said in French, le roi c'est moi. No, he said l'état c'est moi. But le roi means king, so viceroy means second in king. So what one way to read the Gemara is that David will be the old David, or his traditions will be the king, and the new David will be the viceroy. The other way to read the Gemara is that the new David will be the king, and the old David will be his assistant. That's, in fact, how Rashi reads it. If you look at Rashi on the left-hand column, Rashi says, V'David HaMelech, David Chadash Melech, the new David will be the king. David Malkum Asherakum, I will establish a new David. David HaMelech Sheini Lo, and the old David will be the assistant. K'dixiv Nasi Lohem V'loks Siv Melech. It will be a Nasi, which is a lower rank than a Melech king. On the other hand, the Yad Rama, another one of the great Rishonim who wrote a Perish on Masechah Sanhedrin, Spanish Rishon, he reversed it. And he says, unlike Rashi, he disagrees with Rashi, and he says, no, old David will be the king, and the new David will be the assistant. So I now pose the following question to you. What are they debating? What's the issue here? Aside from, you know, how you interpret the Pesukim and the Gemara, what's the issue as to whether the old David should be the leader and the new David the viceroy, or the new David should be the melech and the old David should be the viceroy? What do you think's at stake there? Think about this from a broader perspective. What's at stake between, in the debate between Rashi and the Yad Rama as to how to understand this Gemara? Any suggestions? So I think of Moshe Rabbeinu. We all know that Moshe Rabbeinu was prohibited from entering Eretz Yisrael. His sovereignty, his leadership ended just at the border where he died. And the question is, why is it the case that Moshe Rabbeinu died there, and was he unable to lead Bnei Yisrael into Eretz Yisrael? Of course, his long-standing dream, desire, and aspiration. So what the Pesukim say is that he sinned. He smote the stone, the rock, for water rather than talking to it. That's the Pasuk says. That was his chet. That he, instead of speaking to the stone and asking the rock to deliver water, he hit the rock. Question is, what does that mean? What does that signify? What's so terrible about that? So one way that I've, over the years, discussed with you in understanding Moshe Rabbeinu's sin is that a new set of challenges awaited Bnei Yisrael in the land of Israel, in Eretz Yisrael, a whole new set of challenges. And that required a new leadership, which was younger, more attuned to the changes, the new challenges, a younger generation taking over a new land. And the older generation of leadership, which had been tried in the fires of the slavery of Mitzrayim and the 40 years of wandering in the desert and all the tribulations and dealing with the Jewish people and the complaints and the chatayim and the failures, it ground an earlier generation of leadership down, and they were worn, which is why Moshe maybe kind of lost a little patience with the stone, and he hit it because he was worn by the challenges of taking Bnei Yisrael out of Mitzrayim. Yeshua did not bear the mantle of leadership during those trying times. He was the assistant. He was Nar. He was a serve Moshe, but he was not the leader. And so he didn't have the same burnout, you might say, the same strain that Moshe had in taking Bnei Yisrael out of Mitzrayim. If you think about this analogously to the founding of the State of Israel, founding the State of Israel required a certain set of talents. But if David Ben-Gurion could somehow have miraculously survived into the early 21st century, as dubious, as great a leader as he might have been, that he could have effectively led the State of Israel in the whole new set of challenges, not creating a state, but dealing with a state that already exists with all the different kinds of challenges and problems and opportunities. Dar dar v'darshav, it says in, I think it's in Tehillim. Each generation comes with its own needs. And so one argument might be that the old David was not suited to leading the Bnei Yisrael into the remarkable new era of Yemos HaMashiach. He was too worn down by the battles and by the challenges and the rebellions and Avshalom and all the different, and Shaul chasing him. He needed a new vision, fresh perspective, new set of eyes, youthfulness, so he could never be the leader of Bnei Yisrael into the future. He could certainly provide wise guidance from behind the scenes as a viceroy, as a number two figure, but not as a number one figure, because a new generation required a new kind of leadership. That's one way to understand it. And that would be one way to understand the Yad Ramah, one way to understand Rashi, that it had to be the new king who would be the Melech, the new David, not the old David. The Yad Ramah, on the other hand, might be arguing, he doesn't say this explicitly, but this is my reading of it, he might be arguing that in the remarkable new era of the Mashiach, exactly what we need is the wisdom of the past. Don't give me this stuff about new generation of leadership. What could be better than the Kedusha, the godless, the experience, the wisdom of somebody like David HaMelech? He has to take the leadership role. Now, the new person could assist him. He's got energy, youthfulness. He can go out there and do stuff, handle things, implement, execute. But one wants the vision and the wisdom and the depth and the experience of a wizened leader like David HaMelech. And so the debate between Yad Ramah and Rashi may be a debate about what kind of leader is best suited to taking on new challenges. The experienced leader who has wisdom, knowledge, gone through it all, or the leader with youthful energy, a new vision, and a new perspective. Maybe that's the debate. And by the way, this is quite a legitimate debate about leadership in any era or any time. Are we better off with a 78-year-old president, which we will soon be having come another week or so? Or would we be better off with a 45-year-old president who was very, very young and youthful? Take a look at Obama, who was very, very young when he ascended to the presidency, or John F. Kennedy. Very, very young leaders. They lack the seasoning of the wisdom that comes from what Joe Biden has, 40 years in the Senate. A lot of experience, knows how to get stuff done. But does he have a new vision, a new perspective that maybe a country needs, or are we better off with that experience? I'm obviously not taking any positions at all. And in fact, the two candidates for president were both men well into their 70s. But I just mean to say that in general, this is a fair question to ask about what the optimal kind of leadership is for a country facing new challenges. Yes, Howard, I see your hands up.
Yes, I have a question. I don't see how this image of David fits into the Mashiach we talked about, for coming on a donkey, being unassuming, not a powerful person. And I want to suggest that the Gemara isn't saying he's going to be Mashiach. It's saying he's going to be ruling Bnei Yisrael. So the question is it possible that David isn't the Mashiach, but he becomes the ruler of Bnei Yisrael, and Mashiach has a different role? Because how does that David fit into what we've been talking about personality-wise? He's a warrior, and we said that we've discussed the last few weeks that it's not a warrior, it's a simple peacemaker. So is this an additional position? And it doesn't say that he's the Mashiach. It said that he's going to reinstate it as Malchus.
That's a very good question. Very good question, Howard. I'm not sure I have an answer to that question. I can only say that the standard way of thinking about the Mashiach, he's usually called Melech Mashiach, usually thought of as a king. And so I think here the Gemara is probably using that same model of Melech Mashiach. If we look at the Rambam, Hilchos Melachim, it's Melech HaMashiach. It could be that the debate here is, you're right, David, way back in his youth, may have been one particular kind of person. But maybe by the time he aged, if he came to be the second round Mashiach, he might be more of a riding on a donkey quiet kind of type. I really don't know. It's a very, very good question. So I don't have a definitive answer to it. Very good question. There are many, many different visions of what the Mashiach is like. We've seen all different approaches in the Gemara. And this may just be another one of those differences. In any case, I'm really just suggesting a way of thinking about this machlokas, this debate between the Yad Ramah and Rashi on this Gemara, which is a hard Gemara to understand. Like, what's this all about? Like, why would you need an assistant? Like, what does the Mashiach need an assistant for? Like, where does that come from? Where's a tradition for an assistant? And so maybe the idea is that you need a balance between the forces of fresh youthfulness on the one hand and seasoned leadership on the other hand. And the question is, how do you balance that? The debate is, how do you balance it? Do you balance it more in the favoring youthful vision and leadership and placing wisdom as a secondary guiding break, maybe kind of role, you know? You need good advisors? Or is it that the primary leader is the wise person with considerable experience, and the young leader, the viceroy, is the implementer, the chief executive officer, but not the chairman of the board, not the person who sets the meeting. So in any case, I think on this analysis, which is just my conjecture, but on this analysis, you would need a combination of both. Because there needs to be not only a melech, but a nasi lemelech. It needs to be a number two person. The question is, what's the relative weight? We place on number one, number two. Do we place greatest value on wisdom versus youthfulness? Or do we place greater value on youthfulness with wisdom as a kind of a break or a frame to help guide the youthful leader? In fact, it's often the case that young, like if you think about John F. Kennedy, many of the senior advisors surrounded him were men of very considerable experience, brain trust. So not an uncommon model. All right, be all that as it may, it could be that the Gemara's reading, this whole reading, you know, the odd juxtaposition of these two psukim where they're not read, I think, in the most literal, direct way to create a question and a solution, maybe all ways of dealing with this question of what constitutes the optimal forms of leadership. And maybe Moshe Sokol is thinking about this right now because we are in a period of the transition of leadership in the United States, in Israel. And, you know, Netanyahu is a very controversial leader in Israel, and various assistants, people who used to be his assistants, have broken from him and have established competing parties, Naftali Bennett, Gideon Saar. And it's kind of a similar model. You have the old Netanyahu being the highly experienced, accomplished leader on the one hand. You have more youthful rebels against Netanyahu's more seasoned leadership. And the debate is, do you want a youthful person with a fresh perspective, or do you want the guy who's managed to do all the achievements that Netanyahu has done? So because I'm seeing all this around me now, I'm thinking of this way of reading the Gemara. I can't really say, but this is my suggestion. Okay, let's continue. Any other comments about that before I proceed? I see somebody said, Alex, Yoshua was still the generation who left Egypt. Yes, he was of that generation, but he was much younger, and he did not bear the burdens of leadership, and therefore was not didn't have the frustrations and the burnout maybe that Moshe Rabbeinu, as great as he was, may have experienced, reflected in the hitting rather than speaking to the rock, as I was explaining before. Okay, let's continue with the Gemara. We are now on the next to the last line of the Gemara. First word, Darash Rabbi Simlai. Rabbi Simlai gave a drasha. My diksiv, what does it mean when it says in Amos, Heve hamisavim es yom Hashem? You should be desirous of the day of Hashem, when the Mashiach comes. Lama zelachem yom Hashem? Why do you say that this is the day of God? Hu choshech, the lower. It's darkness and not light. So what's the drasha? So here's his drasha. Mashal, this is a parable, four or two, l'tarnagol v'ataleif, to a chicken. Who knows what an ataleif is? A bat. Shayu mitzapin l'or. Both the chicken, sounds like Aesop's fables, right? a chicken and a bat. They're both looking forward to the light. Umbale tarnagol atlef. The chicken said to the bat, Ani mitzapa la'ora, I look forward to light, sh'ora shalihi, because light is mine. I can benefit from light. Ata, and you, lamalacha ora, what do you need light for? You're a bat. Bats have no vision. They navigate via, if I'm not mistaken, ultrasound waves. Isn't that right? Sound waves, something like that? Like radar, kind of? Anybody know? Isn't it like
sonar?
Sound waves?
Sonar.
That's sonar, sound waves, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. Sound waves. So sonar. So they don't, their eyes don't see. They are navigate through other means, which is why you don't want to get in the way of a bat. So you have the bat and a chicken both looking forward to the light. But the chicken says, what benefit do you have, light? What are you looking forward to? You can't see anyway. What difference does it make whether it's light or dark for you? Whereas I benefit from the light. So what this is a reference to, as Rashi explains and as the following Gemara makes clear, to the Jews versus the nations of the world. The nations of the world and the Jews both look forward to the Messianic era. However, Rav Simlai maintains that the Messianic era will be of benefit to the Jews more so than to the non-Jews, because they are like the bats to the visionary chicken. So non-Jews should not be looking forward to the Messianic era, according to Rav Simlai, because they are not going to benefit from the Messianic era. Okay, so one question that needs to be asked about this Gemara is it not the case that in the Messianic era, all the nations of the world, as the Nevi'im say, will come and recognize Hashem's sovereignty? They will bring karbanos in the Beis HaMikdash. There will be a universal enlightenment. The whole world will be enlightened and will be full of faith in Hashem. So is that not something for non-Jews to look forward to? Like, what does Rav Simlai mean? Does he mean, is he a complete anti-universalist? We're talking about the parochialism versus the universalism. We spoke about that a few weeks ago in the teachings of Rabbi Yochanan, who was very much a universalist, as we saw last time. Here Rav Simlai seems to take a much more particularistic position, that only the Jews and not the non-Jews will benefit from Yemos HaMashiach. Now, that's one reading. There is another reading I'd like to suggest, quite a different one, but I'd like to suggest it only after I read the next few lines of Gemara. But before I do that, if I were to ask you, what bird would you choose as a symbol for the Jewish people? Would you choose a chicken? I'll tell you what I would choose. I would choose a dove, because Sefer Tehillim implicitly, but uses the term dove as a reference to the Jewish people. What's with the chicken? You ever seen a chicken? Anybody here ever actually see a chicken? There aren't too many of them wandering around the streets of Brooklyn. Not a particularly attractive creature. I mean, they're pretty
beneficial. Last time they did kaparos.
Yeah, right. Last time you did kaparos. So, I mean, they're sort of a bit dirty. They're pretty beneficial in that they lay eggs, got that, with all the cholesterol. We also eat them. What would Shabbos be without chicken soup? But I don't know if that's why I would call the Jewish people chickens. Like, it just seems like an odd choice for a symbol of the Jewish people, a chicken. Anybody have any thoughts about that? Excuse me?
I think the bat's better than the chicken if I have to choose.
Yeah, right. The bat's better than the chicken. Okay. Especially if it carries coronavirus, because then it can do a lot of bad things.
Is it that we're just clucking around with we're just clucking around aimlessly. You know, we're fat on the bottom. We have no purpose. We're not really going anywhere. We're just clucking around.
Maybe.
It's a criticism of the state of Jews, even.
I think it is. And I think that a Tarnagol, well, first of all, there's a Tarnagol and a Tarnagoless. What's the difference between the two?
They're all women, right? Sounds like a Seinfeld.
Well, a Tarnagol is a hen. Yeah, a Tarnagol is a male. So males don't lay eggs. A hen lays eggs. So it is choosing the male of the species. But it could be that this symbol is chosen because the Jews have been persecuted, slaughtered like chickens, used for the fiscal eggs they can lay to finance Gentile regimes, but not the most beautiful, powerful, noble of birds. In other words, Jews in exile, and we're talking about in exile because this is before the Mashiach has come, maybe that is a good metaphor for the Jewish people. Maybe Rav Simlai really is hitting the nail on the head that, you know, Goyim are bats. We're not much better. We're a bunch of chickens. Yeah, rooster. Right. Oh, that's an interesting thought. As I said, it's the male. It's not the female. So a rooster. Huh, interesting. I like that. Abe, thank you so much. Yes, Tarnagol is the male, which would be a rooster. But what you're saying, as in foreshadowing the light, Abe makes a wonderful point. Maybe that's the rooster who sees the first light of the morning and wakes everybody up. And so maybe it's not the Jew as persecuted chicken, but the Jew as a harbinger, as a detector of the messianic light, which is around the corner. I like that, Abe, very much. Thank you so much. Yeah, roosters do that. Very, very good point. And that way, the Tarnagol is even more of a visionary than the Tarnagoless, because it is the rooster who, what sounds do roosters make? You know, they make sounds to welcome the morning and welcome the morning light. So maybe the Tarnagol is really in some ways the antithesis, as Abe is kind of suggesting, of the bat. The bat can't see anything, but the Tarnagol picks up the first rays of the rising of the sun and awakens everybody to the rising of the sun. And so in some ways, the Tarnagol is the harbinger of the Mashiach himself. So a very interesting reading. It's not what I was thinking of. I was thinking, as I say, Jew more is persecuted, but maybe that's a really a better reading. I like that very much. Whereas the Atlef is totally blind, and the Tarnagol can see during the daytime, but not only can he see during the daytime, but he can pick up the slightest rays of the sun in the rising early dawn, the rising of the sun in the early dawn. So that's really quite an interesting reading. Thank you, Abe. I really appreciate that. I like that very much. That would be why he would be mitzapta la'or, why he would be looking forward to the light. That's exactly what a rooster does. He's up waiting for the dawn. So, yeah, that would really, in a way, define the Jewish people as ani mamen bavuna shlema via sabashiach viafal pishi yisma mea achake lo, even though I'm always waiting. The Tarnagol, the rooster's always waiting for the crack of dawn. Like the Jew is always waiting for the Mashiach. And so really, maybe that's a brilliant metaphor for the Jew waiting anxiously and eagerly for the arrival of the dawn. Very good. Question I have for you is, why do you think the bat is waiting for the dawn? Like, why would a bat wait for dawn? It doesn't make any sense to him whether it's light or day, night or day. Can't see anyway. So why would the bat be looking, waiting for the dawn? You hear the question? I understand why the Tarnagol is waiting for the dawn, waiting for the light. But why is this bat waiting for a light? The Gemara says, Rav Samulai, they're both waiting for the light. And the Tarnagol says, why are you waiting for? Well, he has a good question. Why is the bat waiting for the day? Anybody have any thoughts about that?
To go to sleep.
Going to sleep? Bats sleep during the day.
Bats are nocturnal. They stay up at night and they sleep during the day.
Uh-huh. It says looking forward to the daytime so that he can go to sleep. Okay, that's an interesting thought. Very interesting thought. Maybe what that means is that whereas the Jew is waiting for the light, the daytime, to flourish in the daytime, the bat is waiting to go to sleep. The opposite, the least functional, useful way of using the dawn, daylight, is to go to sleep. So the Goyim here are portrayed in this respect in a rather negative light, as looking forward to the daytime so they can sleep, rather than the Jew who is looking forward to the daytime, so like the Tarnagol, he can call us to a new light. Okay, very good. Excellent. I thank you both for those wonderful suggestions. Now, I told you that the next couple lines of Gemara will shed a fresh light on this, so let's continue to the next couple lines of the Gemara. V'hainu, this is where Ansadi Tesamid Aleph, so everybody, we can have a seum, celebrate that we've just turned the page. Another daf under our belts, that is a Baruch Hashem, an accomplishment. Ahainu di amr le'ahu mina l'rabbi abahu. This sectarian told Rabbi Abahu. Emesai asi Mashiach. When will the Mashiach come, he asked him. This min asked Rabbi Abahu. Rabbi Abahu answered, L'chi chafiluhu chashucha lahanhu inshi, which means when the darkness covers over those people who are not Jewish. That's when the Mashiach is going to come. Well, obviously the min takes umbrage and he says, Amalei, Melech Kalayit Li, are you cursing me? You're telling me the Mashiach's going to come when I'm going to experience darkness? That's not a very nice, friendly thing to say. And so Rabbi Abahu responds to the irked min, Amalei Kraksiv. I said this because it's a pasuk. Ki neha choshech yechase eretz, the darkness will cover the land, va'arafil, Arafel Leumim, and pitch darkness will cover the nations of the world. Yolecha Yisrach Hashem, and on you Hashem will shine. Uchodo Alecha Yeroeh, and His honor will be visible upon you. And that ends the dialogue between the men and Rabbi Abahu. So, a couple of questions. Why does this min think that Rabbi Abahu is going to reveal to him when the Mashiach comes? Rabbi Abahu himself doesn't know when the Mashiach is coming. In fact, nobody really knows, as we saw. Even Eliyahu Hanavi, according to one Gemara we saw, doesn't know when the Mashiach is coming. So what's the min's question? And how did Rabbi Abahu silence him by quoting a pasuk? Min doesn't accept the pasuk. So a couple of good questions, right? So this leads us to wonder who the identity of this min is. And I will tell you something. Typically, not always, but typically, when the Gemara refers to a min, it typically, not always, but typically refers to a Christian, a sectarian Jew who broke away from the Jewish tradition and worshiped Jesus. Well, if you think of it in those terms, this dialogue has a whole different meaning. If you think of the min as being a Christian, then when he asked Rabbi Abahu, when is your Mashiach coming? What did he mean to say? But what he may have meant to say is, my Mashiach already came. What about your guy waiting off in the distance? He'll never show up. When is your Mashiach going to come? What he was really doing was, this Christian was really attacking the Jew from the theological perspective of a Christian. Oh, your Mashiach, he'll never come. When is he going to come? Mine already came. I got a Mashiach ready. I'm good. What are you Jews, you benighted Jews, you're waiting and waiting and waiting for the Mashiach. He's never going to show up. When is he going to come? With me? See how, if you read this as a Christian polemic against the Jews, the question makes a lot of sense. And Rabbi Abbo's answer makes sense too, because the Christians respect the Old Testament. They call it the Old Testament. They regard it as having been superseded by the New Testament. But nevertheless, they regard Tanakh as being of divine origin. And so Rabbi Abbo can respond to this min using the words of Yeshayahu. Let us remember that, and I think Michael was the one who reminded, Michael Klein reminded us of this last week, that one of the most important chapters in Yeshayahu for Christianity, one of the most important chapters in Tanakh that Christians use to read Christianity into the Tanakh was from Yeshayahu. So they liked Yeshayahu. It was a Navi on which they try to base elements of their religion. And so it is very acute and perceptive and effective for Rabbi Abbo to respond explicitly from that Navi, who was so important to the Christian rereading of Tanakh, as they did in developing what they call the New Testament, having superseded the Old Testament. So one way to read this is as a kind of a dialogue between Christian and Jew, in which, of course, since the dialogue is written by us, the Jew has the upper hand and gets the last word in, with an effective retort to the Christian. And so we have on this reading a kind of a hidden polemic between Christians and Jews about the arrival of the Mashiach. And now remember that, go back to the daf just before, the Gemara itself applies this dialogue between Rabbi Abbo and the men to the parable of the rooster, and I'll use the more proper word, not chicken, really roost, not hen, and certainly not. I was using chicken, I should really say rooster. Rooster and the bat. Now, I ask you, from this perspective, how do you understand the dialogue now between the rooster and the bat? You with me? The Gemara explicitly says, after mentioning the parable, the Gemara explicitly says, V'hainu, the Amaleahu Mina le Rabbi Abbo. And this dialogue between rooster and bat is exactly the dialogue between the Min, read Christian, and Rabbi Abbo. So what is he saying? You with me? How do you interpret the parallel that the Gemara draws quite explicitly between the bat and the Christian on the one hand, and the Jew and the Tarnagol, Rabbi Abbo and the Tarnagol on the other? Everybody with me? Did you follow me? Nod your head. Are those heads I can see? Yes, no, yes. You with me? Yeah, okay, good. Okay, thank you. At least I get some reaction. Okay, Howard, yeah, thank you. Howard, do you have a hypothesis?
Well, yes. I think that since it's going to be darkness for the non-Jew, then the bat wants light. He doesn't want darkness. He's also looking forward to the light, and he's kind of saying, I hope the darkness doesn't come. He's relying on the light and trying to ignore the darkness that's going to be coming later. He's kind of arguing and saying, no, or he's kind of preferring to stay away from the dark. He wants to get into the light, even though that's not his normal desire, but he's trying to prevent what the Pasuk says here. So he doesn't want that time to come, so he's looking for light also.
Not sure. I mean, if the bat is compared to a Christian, then the Jewish rooster would be saying, the Christian would be, remember, in this dialogue, this theological dialogue or debate or polemic between Jew and Christian. So from the perspective of the Gemara, the Christian is a bat, that is to say, he is blind. He thinks that the Mashiach has already arrived. But he's flying around in the dark. Of course the Mashiach hasn't arrived. We're still living in a dark place. One of the main arguments in Jewish polemics against Christians is, what kind of a Messiah is your God if the world is in such horrific shape? What a mess our world is in. You couldn't have a very effective Messiah if he leads the world in such awful shape. And to compare a Christian on this reading, which is my reading, I haven't seen this anywhere, but on this reading, to compare a Christian to a bat is to say, you're living in darkness. You can't see anything. You think your Messiah has arrived? Look how dark the world is. You don't even know when light is. You don't know what Mashiach truly is. I, Tarnagol, always look for the light of the Mashiach, and I can tell when the Mashiach comes. I have my eyes open. I can see. And I always alert to the possible arrival of the Mashiach. You, Christian, bat, are living in darkness because you think the Mashiach has arrived, but the world is really a mess. It's a black, dark place. And therefore, you're not looking, you can't be looking for the light because what you believe in, the Mashiach, has left the world a very black, dark place. So if you take this reading that I suggested as a polemic between Jewish and Christian, where the Christian attacks the Jew, attacks Rabbi Abbahu responds appropriately, then Rabbi Simlai's drasha is not about universalism versus particularism. Remember, that's how I first started out? Rabbi Simlai seems to take a very particularistic as opposed to universalistic view, and that bad things for the non-Jews. Whereas if you read this in the context of a Jewish-Christian polemic, he's speaking specifically about Jewish sectarians, namely Christians who've abandoned their Jewish roots or never had them, but they are minim, they are a min as a sectarian. And it's not about universalism versus particularism generally, it's about the narrow fraternal debate between Jews and Christians, and the rooster is the Rabbi Abbahu, who was defending himself against the attack of the Christian and arguing that, in fact, it is the Christian who is blind rather than the Jew who waits in a futile way for the Mashiach. So if you take this Gemara as a whole, as one unit, one sugya, so to speak, reading this as a Jewish-Christian polemic really changes our understanding of the debate between Rabbi Abbahu and the men, as it does shed light on Rabbi Simlai's drasha. He's too engaging in a pro-Jewish polemic against Christian attack. And the Christians attacked the Jews. They weren't very nice to them. Okay, you with me, everybody? So I offer that reading to you as something to ponder. I haven't seen it anywhere. Maybe somebody says it, but I certainly haven't seen it anywhere. But it's a good spot for us to complete our shiur. Next Monday, we will look at the question of how long the Messianic era lasts.